Matthew Woollard, who I think is known to many of you as head of AHDS history. I'm going to say if we can try and keep the papers to about 15 minutes to give us some time for a sort of general discussion at the end. Matthew's already made a preemptive strike and said he may take longer, but I think we probably end up averaging out. That's roughly the right time. So, Matthew.
Thank you very much. What I want to talk about is to try and examine some of the impact of digital resources on economic and demographic history over the last 5 years or so. And I'm going to do this by first talking about some, giving some terms of reference, because I think that they're different for economic and demographic history than they are for the humanities. Second, I want to consider some data, some analysis we've done, which sheds light on the way in which different digital resources have impacted on economic and demographic history. And finally, at the end, I'm going to present some tentative conclusions based on the results of this analysis. The first point I want to make is that it's necessary to make a distinction between different types of resources which economic and demographic historians might use in their research. And time considerations mean that, obviously, I can't cover all of economic and demographic history, but I'm also going to try not to cover or to talk about teaching unless the resources have the same or dual value. What is clear and what we've heard this morning makes it even clearer is that electronic resources have transformed the process of research in history. The digitization of back issues of journals and of important and sometimes not so important secondary sources are placing vast quantities of material in much closer reach of the historian, at least from the library to the desktop. And improved functionality makes these old resources much easier to use. I guess it's a matter of debate, or it's only a matter of debate, when every single printed text from the developed world and will be available on the internet. That will almost certainly be the case in 50 years, and quite possibly a lot sooner. The progress will be jerky, there'll be technical and bibliographical problems, but it will happen. I don't think this will revolutionize the basic research methods, though. It will make some of them much easier, and it will help to democratize research. And because of this belief, I'm less concerned with the impact of all digital resources. This form of resource, the digital version of the printed text, I'm much less interested in. I'm also less concerned about it because I believe that the impact of this digitization process is mostly, not completely, but it's mostly an economic one. The cost of the supply of resources will be spread much more evenly by user over the whole of the community. Researchers will spend less time looking for resources, looking for books. So I want to move to talk about, I don't want to talk really very much about digital facsimiles. This is a facsimile of John Graunt's Natural and Political Observations, the first big table which aggregates causes of death by the year in which they occur. These are digital facsimiles, digital surrogates, digital reproductions, call them what you may. And these types of sources may or may not be enhanced. This is a page from the census of 1831. These may or may not be enhanced with other material which has been digitized in a different way, or in a way to increase their functionality. This particular resource isn't just a browsable digital version of some rather dreary census material. It also includes finding aids, essays, interpretative essays, and some legislation. And I think that the other form of resource that we could consider, things like electronic journals or electronic publications, I think they need to be discussed, but I believe also that they're less important, at least in the world of economic and demographic history. I'm not saying that they're not important, I'm saying that I believe that they're less. So I'm going to concentrate on a digital resource which practitioners in economic or demographic history use in their research, and that is the database. This is a very poor facsimile of the 1821 census for Hendon. This is quite interesting for social historians as well, because not only are the usual demographic indicators collected here, but also in this column the rent, which is pretty unusual, the number of windows in each house, and also the number of dogs in each house. This is rather unusual, but it's material like this which I think cries out for digitization. In this presentation, databases and data sets are things which can be analyzed by analytical methods, or at least have the potential of being analyzed in such a fashion. They're often, but by no means always, numeric. And they can be used as reference works. Again, if you trusted this source, you could say that 835 people in a certain area of London in 1657 died of phlox or smallpox. It's a reference work. The information can be extracted and used in a historical work. From the point of view of the historical profession, these distinctions can be allied to primary and secondary sources. The same data can be reproduced in a format which can be analysed by different methods. So, Graunt's Table of Deaths and the online historical population images of facsimiles, as is the manuscript census illustration, if they're in database form, they can be used for analytical purposes, and that's really what I want to concentrate on. What evidence is there that resources like this are being used by economic and demographic historians? Well, I believe that to assess the impact of a very broad range of digital resources on historical research is going to be a never-ending and almost impossible task. The detailed material which is necessary to make proper prognostications is just not in the public domain. Even the deep analysis of weblogs only gives us one side of the picture. One can use some material to give one an indication of what has changed over time. The publicly available figures which refer to the AHDS history's usage statistics, which detail the number of studies in our collection which are being used in any given year, gives an indication of change over time. The green bars show how collections or studies within our collection have grown since 1999. About 430 data sets and other digital collections. 2004, we're almost up to 600. By this point of this year, we're over 600 collections already. Discrete, complete historical sources. The usage is pretty small, around 180 or so people in each of the years, or rather 180 uses are made of these data each year. That's a complete collection being taken by a researcher and brought to their desktops. And we can be pretty certain that in most cases they're using it. They wouldn't go to the trouble of filling in a form, getting and paying for a CD. In 2004, everything is online and downloadable. Massive increase in usage. What does this show? Well, it shows me that we've put in a download system. It doesn't tell me anything really at all about usage. Lots more people know what we're doing. Lots more people are downloading our material, but that to me is not evidence of any real significant usage of the material. I think there's another method of assessing the impact of digital resources is to start from the other end and to look at published research in journals and monographs to see the real recorded usage. This method, I think, actually underestimates usage just as much as this indicator overestimates it. And I think it underestimates it because of the naivety of the historian. If there's something on the internet, they don't want to cite it. Books are more important than electronic resources. Historians don't know actually how to cite electronic resources. We've seen some examples today of how electronic resources should be cited, and we've seen them done correctly. This is a pretty specialist audience. In the general historical domain, I don't see that happening. There is the issue of persistent identifiers. which has been mentioned once before today. And I believe that is another reason why historians find things difficult to cite. So what I did is I looked at the Economic History Review. It's electronic, it's fully searchable, for the period 2000 to 2004. And I looked at a smaller demographic journal, one called Local Population Studies, over the same period. In total, there are 144 articles. Of those, around 80% implicitly used electronic data. Of those which implicitly used it, somewhere nearer 60% or so explicitly used it. They said, I've analysed my database. And again, of those which implicitly use it, a much smaller number reference it in any meaningful way. And when I mean meaningful, I'm accepting this. I must acknowledge the warm and generous, you can read this, which leads to a footnote, which leads to a report in the British Library. But that's really what they were citing. They were really citing a data set. And the data set has a pretty clear way of being cited, but no, it's an acknowledgement and a footnote to a reference which is not really very useful. So this is still an explicit indication that data is being used, from my point of view. There's change over time, though, which is much more important and much more interesting. The proportion in these two journals which explicitly use data hardly changes. Okay, it starts at 63% and goes up to 85%, but there's pretty much of a level playing field here. There may have been a bit of a jump in 2000, but the other 4 years under observation, it's about the same. Those which explicitly mention data is a bit more problematic, and this may be something to do with the way in which I've collected the information. I think I've been reasonably consistent, but there's not a trend there. But what there really is a trend in the bottom line, is that historians seem to be even worse at citing historical electronic resources. And that's perhaps one of the things we need to change. So of these resources, of the electronic resources either in CD form or on the web, there is some progress over the period. The numbers are very small. Over the whole of this period, there are only 16 mentions of the World Wide Web or HTTP or something else that one could clearly say was a web-based resource. 16 out of 144 articles. One in the year 2000 and eight in the year 2004. It only gives an indication of impact and of slightly increasing impact as well. But what's clear from this analysis is that large proportions of economic and demographic historians are using data. Most of these data are not in the public domain. And lastly, that historians aren't very good at citing electronic material. I think that when electronic resources are correctly referenced and the value of the creation of electronic resources, including data sets, is acknowledged as a work analogous to an article or a monograph, then the real impact of these resources will be able to be made. So they're being used. Around half of the data sets being used in these scholarly works are ones which are in the AHDS history collection or are available in other websites, the Scottish Economic History Database, the UK Data Archive, International Institute of Social History, European State Finance Database, and EHNet. And also the data CDs, which are used, a couple of these are now completely out of print, and are not available from any digital repository. What's clear also from this analysis is that if you remove personal websites, if you remove research papers and institutional repositories, you end up with one large-scale digital resource that's been funded by UK funding councils, which is cited in these two journals over the last 5 years. Now, I know that there's a time lag in terms of publication, but I don't think that's very good. One project, and it's a historian who cited a book and then puts in brackets at the end, almost in an embarrassed fashion, I found this at www.bookchris.ac.uk. I find that pretty extraordinary. I think this lack of visibility of large, well-funded, well-executed electronic resources not being used by scholars is, I believe, simply that they feel no real need to make reference to them. If I cite an article from the Economic History Review in something I'm writing, I don't say whether I found it on Blackwell's, I don't say whether I found it on JSTOR, or I don't say whether I took it out of the library. The method of delivery is relatively unimportant. I'm going to make three very quick points to finish. This concept that we've heard already today about the distinction between the library on the desktop and the archive on the desktop. I think that part of the paradigm for the future can't just be the library on the desktop. This will happen. It is inevitable. Like how it's done, how it's targeted, how it's focused, what we've heard today about the managerial aspects of this, is going to be difficult to understand, but it will happen. I think there must be space for the digital archive on the desktop, and I believe that there are important implications here for digital repositories and the use of the Open Archives Initiative. The second point is a really trivial point that I want to make for the future, and that is that historians need to learn how to cite this sort of stuff properly. If they don't, we're never going to see the bottom-up end results of this sort of work. And I think, thirdly, that a much greater awareness of material that is available should be made, and a greater awareness of that material in itself. I want to quote from the British Academy report from April. It said, and this is referring to the Economic History Society, they said, its members are generally unwilling to give up exclusive access to the stuff of their academic status until they have fully exploited it. At the same time, they recognize that researchers generally benefit from access to one another's data, especially as more and varied findings are drawn from it for further use, and additional data sets may be built to extend it. So why doesn't the Economic History Society say to people who are its members, if you're making data sets, make it available. Make it quality, make it available. Show it off, don't just publish the results. And I think that these forms of resources should be made available in as many ways possible. This is an image from the 1881 census of England and Wales. Cricketers here, William Grace is tucked in there somewhere. This sort of source has been digitized. It's available through a website at the University of Essex. It's also available on CD from the Genealogical Society of Utah. And it's also available as part of the North Atlantic Project, Population Project website. Multiple resources targeted towards slightly different users. I think that the British Academy report, while hugely welcomed, covered the humanities and the social sciences with no distinction between the two. History, as we all know, straddles the humanities and the social sciences, and just as the main funding bodies sometimes have difficulties in determining whether some history is humanities or the same history is social science oriented, the need for provision of new electronic resources needs to be viewed from different directions to make maximum impact. The literature survey, the Economic History Review, and local population studies demonstrates the increased use, perhaps even dependence on databases and data sets for economic and social and demographic history. And while secondary sources are necessary to facilitate research, the digitization of primary materials like these seems to be something which is just as important to this particular user community.